It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, will the federal government reach an agreement on raising the debt ceiling before it runs out of money? We'll find out what the political parties have put on the negotiating table and what's at stake for the American people. First, have you ever tried to learn a new language? Maybe you did it in school. Maybe you're in the process of learning one right now. Even if it was a challenge, research from around the world shows it's worth the effort. Being multilingual can boost everything from our creativity and critical thinking to our cognitive health. Our next guest has spent years studying the connection between language and the brain, and that's the subject of her new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with more than one language? Have you taken language classes as a kid or a grown-up? What was the best way for you to learn that second language? Did it come naturally? Or are you like me, and it's tough to learn another language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Viorica Marianne is the Ralph and Jean Sundin Endowed Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Viorica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dig into the benefits of learning more languages, this is your life's work in a lot of ways. What is it that you find so fascinating about the connection between language and our brains?
I've always loved languages and been interested in the relationship between language and mind. I think most people think about us, our brains producing language, and don't understand that this relationship between language and mind is bidirectional. The languages we use also shape the way we think, shape our minds and our brains. So growing up with more than one language, I've always been interested in this relationship between mind and language.
Let's talk a little bit about how our brain handles language. There was some thought, I think, that, hey, here's a language center for our brains. And as we like analyze and scan our brains, we're going to figure out where language is coming from. If I'm reading you right, Viorica, it's a lot more complicated than that. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. So I actually myself, when I first started, was, you know, almost 30 years ago, was interested in seeing whether one language is located in one part of the brain and another language in another part of the brain. And that's a question I get asked often. But it turns out the brain is a much more distributed network of processing. So both languages share much of this network, and language itself is this broad network of activation in various areas of the brain that change depending on whether we comprehend language, produce language, whether we're focusing on meaning or form or syntax. So it's really a very complex neural activity.
Now, a lot of the history of the study of language has been on people who maybe speak only one language, like me. You and some of your colleagues are expanding that. What kind of things are we starting to learn about language by studying people like you who grew up with more than one language?
Well, you know, I think that if we only study monolingual brains and monolingual minds, we're missing a big part of the picture. And we're getting an incomplete and really inaccurate understanding of the human potential, of the potential of the human mind. And think about this as being similar to how in the field of medicine, heart disease at one point was studied only in men and later found to be manifesting differently in women, or diabetes was studied primarily in white populations, only to later discover that the indigenous populations of North and South America process sugar differently. In the same way, if we only study monolingual brains, we are really leaving out a lot of important information out. And especially considering that, in fact, the majority of the world's population outside the United States is bilingual and multilingual. So it's very, very common in many countries all around the world to grow up with more than one language. And even in the United States, those numbers are changing. So it is increasingly becoming important to not limit our research to a very small, narrow subset of what are called weird populations that represent only a small, so weird because they are coming from white, educated, industrialized, and rich democratic nations, which are the minority of the world's population. So in order to really understand the human mind, the human potential, we need to expand our definition of that.
Talking to Villarica Marian. Her new book is called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're trying to learn a new language right now, we'd love to hear about that. If you grew up speaking more than one language, what was that like for you? How did it shape the way you think, or the way you think you think? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into multilingual people here, Villarica. And one thing people might wonder about is for kids, the worry, and I wondered about this too, the worry that, okay, if a kid is brought up with two languages at the same time, are they going to be confused? Is it going to slow down their language growth? You have a pretty solid answer on this one in the book.
Yeah, that's a very common misconception. We often think that, and even advise people not to raise children with more than one language. And there is absolutely no evidence for that. Our human brain is built to be able to handle multiple codes of communication. And if you think of codes of communication as going beyond language and including other symbolic systems like math, like music, like nonverbal communication, you can see that the brain is able to seamlessly learn and integrate and master all these forms of communication. So multiple natural languages can be accommodated just as well. And you can see this in children and in infants all around the world growing up with multiple languages. And in the United States, we often see differences across social economic classes. So upper classes, upper middle classes usually understand the benefit of raising children with multiple languages, and often, sign them up for lessons, language lessons, or hire tutors, or send them on programs abroad, and really understand that being bilingual and multilingual has all these benefits, economic benefits, social benefits, lifelong wonderful outcomes, and encourage that. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we often have groups that are the lowest social economic status that are actively discouraged from speaking another language under the assumption that's damaging or confusing or bad for them. And there is, again, no evidence for that. And a lot of those recommendations come from biases that are really rooted in something else rather than really language.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Well, I'm just curious what your speaker's advice would be about the older people. I'm talking about retired people. What would be the best way for them to learn another language? Because there's many of us who did not have language when we were younger, variations of language. So I'm wondering what she thinks is the best route to go to learn another language.
Great question, Susan. Villarica, what advice do you have for Susan?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this topic, Susan. It's actually an excellent topic. And before I go into the how, if you would let me, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the benefits for aging,
please.
And the aging brain. Yeah, so we now know that individuals who know two or more languages tend to develop dementia, Alzheimer's, and other types of dementia on average 4 to 6 years later than individuals who only speak one language. And countries that are bilingual or multilingual have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's. So it really does seem to be the case that having multiple languages and giving your brain this constant workout of juggling multiple languages translates to positive neural and cognitive health outcomes later in life, what's known as cognitive reserve and neural reserve. And the analogy I like to give is if you imagine taking a certain road home every day for many years, and then one day on your way home, that road collapses. If there are other roads that have been built to your house over the years, you will have no problem rerouting and getting to your destination. But if that's the only road that has been built, then you are in trouble. And in the same way, when you have multiple languages, if one neural pathway in the brain has been impacted and is no longer available to you, because you have multiple languages that have built memories, associations, experiences over the years, you are able to rely and compensate functionally for that anatomical deterioration. So it's a wonderful thing to learn another language as you get older. As far as how to do it, the one thing I would say is to choose something that you can engage in long-term, every day, systematically. So you, it's something that's sustainable. And then from there, choose a way that works best for your personality. Some people prefer to engage in social interaction on learning language. So maybe trade language lessons with someone. Some people prefer to do it on their own online. You can also trade language lessons online or use apps. There is a really a variety of apps right now that are built in a way that takes advantage of game design and rewards learning with all sorts of badges and pings and really gets the serotonin and endorphins and all the positive chemicals going. So you are motivated and inclined to keep up with your lessons. So whatever really is likely to get you to continue and stay with your practice will be very helpful. Make sure you do it regularly. And from there on, the only other thing to consider is just really think about what language you are most likely to find an affinity for. Is this a language that maybe means something for you because of your personal and family background, or because you have people you'd like to communicate with in that language, or you'd like to travel to that country, or you'd like to watch entertainment, consume entertainment in that language? So if you have something to which you're connected and you do this because you enjoy it rather than yet another thing to do, if you make it an enjoyable, pleasant activity, then you're much more likely to stick with it. And that's what it comes down to, like exercise or investing or anything else. If you do it long term, little by little, it's eventually going to produce the benefits that you're looking for.
Susan, thanks for calling. Hope that helps. We're talking to Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about speaking more than one language. If you do personally speak more than one, when and how did you learn them? Did you grow up, or did you learn them in school or on the job or in a foreign country? Let us know. If you're like me and tried and, you know, only sort of succeeded, you could share that story too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University, talking with her about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, about language, our brains, and the benefits of learning a second or third or fourth language. You could join in with your own story or your questions at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just wanted to let you know that in Milwaukee, for many years now, at least since the early 90s when my kids started going to these schools, we have at least four language immersion schools, Italian, I believe, German, French, and Spanish. And they learn in five-year-old kindergarten, first and second grade. I believe they're only taught in the second language, whether it's German or Spanish or French. And then they're taught in both languages. And they learn to speak, to communicate with the teacher in the second language. And then when they're tested at fourth grade for the reading levels, they score way at the top, if not first place.
Wow.
In the state or scores. So you don't have to worry about them having problems later in learning because they learn very well.
I gotcha, Mike. Thanks for that call. Viorica, in our schools here in the U.S., often you don't have a foreign language option until high school. Some people like me don't hit one until college. What do you think of this idea, like as Mike talks about, starting early, much earlier, with something like an immersion school?
Yeah, there are multiple types of bilingual education, but the two-way immersion approach that Mike just mentioned is one of the best ways to bring up children with multiple languages. And by the end, they are fluent in both languages. And Mike is right. There are data suggesting that they score higher on reading and math scores, and this is true for both students from the language majority culture as well as for students from the language minority culture. So you see academic benefits, but you also see social, interpersonal, and personal benefits in terms of interpersonal skills, identity, self-confidence. It just seems to be a really beneficial way of raising children with two languages and results in fluency. So it's a wonderful model. It's very rare because it's more expensive to support, but it is absolutely an excellent way of growing up with two languages. And like we said before, in many countries around the world, it's the norm to grow up with more than one language. So my native language is Romanian. That's the language I spoke at home. And then the official language at the time I was growing up, because it was, I'm from the eastern part of Romania, from Moldova, that was a Soviet republic. It was a Soviet territory. So Russian was the official language. And then English, and then a few other languages sort of get picked up. And then on my husband's side of the family, he grew up with Dutch as the native language, but also is fluent in English, German, some Spanish, some French. And that's really the norm in many places. So it can be a really enriching, both linguistically and culturally and interpersonally, experience.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Before I go back to our callers, Eureka, that you just reminded me of something that I think I learned from your book. You know, the second language is one thing, but that makes it easier to learn language number three, and then that makes it easier to learn language number four. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. With each new language you learn, it becomes easier and easier to learn more languages.
Why?
We don't exactly know. There are a number of ideas and theories. Partly it's because you just get better at learning. You know what to pay attention to. You also are better at controlling competition from the languages you already know and interference. But also with each new language, you have less new information to learn. So when you first learn a new language, there is just so much to learn from, you know, rules of grammar and meaning and form to meaning mapping. Then when you learn a second language, some of those grammatical rules are going to be the same. So you do learn, and even some words will be the same. So you learn new information, but not as much as the first time around. And then as you learn a third language, this third language will overlap in some ways with the first language, in some ways with the second language, in some ways with both. So if you think of it in terms of Venn diagrams, with each new language, your total surface of the Venn diagram circles grows, but the unique surface that's specific to just one of those circles becomes smaller and smaller. So learning promotes learning, and with new learning, you sort of become better at learning. It's not just for language in general. Sort of learning is this virtuous cycle. The more you learn, the better you get at learning.
Talking to Eureka Marianne about her new book, The Power of Language. Back to your calls now. Robin is with us in Delafield. Robin, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just want to say I am 56, and I have a daughter who has lived in Sweden for 6 years. She's now a Swedish citizen, and I decided about a year ago to start studying Swedish. And it's just been, it's like I consider it like my brain workout. It's been so challenging, but it's like in a really good way and frustrating too at times, just because when you just talked about learning other languages, literally there are times when I answer questions in my class, just like yes or no questions, I tap into my high school Spanish. It's hilarious, like what it starts to unlock in your brain when you do learn other languages, like other things pop up. But I have to say, I am all for learning other languages because, like you just said, it is such a good thing for our overall learning. And I feel like it's keeping me younger. And then it's also just providing me a level of comfort. You know, when I travel to visit my daughter, everyone speaks English in Sweden. But, you know, the whole culture and everything in writing is in Swedish. So it's just kind of a nice thing to have.
Robin, thanks so much for sharing that story. Eureka, Robin says her Spanish pops back when she's learning Swedish. I had that. I was never so good at German as when I was trying to learn Polish. What's happening in our brains when we're reaching for that new language we're trying to learn and it reaches back to that one we tried to learn before?
Yeah, thanks. And Robin's experience is wonderful to hear about. She is right to describe that's the word she used, brain workout. And that's exactly really, in a way, what happens. Your brain has to constantly work out to control competition from all these languages to make sure that you are using the language you need to be using and not the other languages. Cognitive, like right now I'm speaking to you in English, I have to make sure my cognitive control mechanisms doesn't let Romanian or Russian or French or Spanish pop out, because they don't do us any good. So your brain is constantly working out. And what's really nice about that is that unlike other types of cognitive exercise that people often engage in, like word puzzles or Sudoku, which, you know, of course, are wonderful and fun, in those cases, you have to take time out of your life to actively do those. But once you're fluent in another language, your brain constantly gets that exercise just by your way of being in the world, because you're constantly facilitating or coactivating or prioritizing one language and then controlling interference from the other language, whether you are speaking, listening to music, reading, whatever you are doing, you have to juggle multiple languages. So it's a constant workout, which is why it's just such an enriching experience. But yes, Robin is right that all languages are coactivated in parallel. So our brain has to make sure it controls coactivation.
Thanks for that call, Robin. Just briefly, Viorica, you talk about languages. You know, we think of English and Swedish and Spanish and so on. But you also talk about music and computer programming and poetry as kinds of language. In just our last minute, how do they resemble those other things we think of as languages?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, of course, they are different in so many ways. But one thing that they have in common is that they're all symbolic systems. They all use symbols, which is what languages are, to encode, transmit, and decode information. As I'm speaking to you now, my brain uses the symbolic system of language to encode my ideas, to encode my thoughts into words, transmit them to you, and then your brain decodes them into ideas again and thoughts to be able to comprehend what I'm saying. The same thing happens with math, where we encode complex ideas into simple notations, with music, to really transmit information across time and space. So that's one of the wonderful things that languages enable us to do, including artificial languages like computer languages.
Eureka, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
That's Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Coming up after the news, the federal government is once again in danger of defaulting on its debts. We'll look at what's behind the partisan divide on the debt ceiling issue and the potential for some kind of compromise. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get ready to kick off a new season of the Women's Football Alliance with the co-owners of the Midwest Mountain Lions from southeastern Wisconsin. Now, the Treasury Department is warning that the federal government will run out of money to pay its bills sometime this summer if Congress and the president can't agree on raising the debt ceiling. It would be the first time that the U.S. has defaulted on its debt. On Monday, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy went to the New York Stock Exchange to argue that any agreement to increase the debt limit would have to include cuts to spending.
We are now $31 trillion in debt. That's more the entire economy of America, 20% more. Think for a moment. That is unsustainable. Without exaggeration, American debt is a ticking time bomb.
A lot going on today on the story. Earlier, a bipartisan group of House members released their outline of an alternative to the speaker's Republican-only outline, while President Biden says that the country's credit is non-negotiable, and House Republican leaders unveiled what they call the Limit, Save, Grow Act this afternoon, with a debt ceiling increase and spending cuts, including a rollback of student loan relief and reversing a boost in IRS funding. The White House continues to say that raising the debt ceiling should not come with any strings attached because it's only covering the costs of previously agreed upon federal funding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see any room for a bipartisan compromise on funding the federal government? Would you be willing to see the U.S. default on its debts for the first time? Are there spending cuts you'd like to see, revenue increases? And do you have any questions about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jasmine Ferrier is a professor of political science at the University of Louisville, where her teaching and research includes all three branches of the U.S. government. Her latest book is called Constitutional Dysfunction on Trial. Jasmine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into dueling plans and outlines, can you remind us what the debt ceiling is and why we have it?
The debt ceiling is the total amount of money that the United States government is authorized to borrow to meet existing legal obligations. Those obligations include Social Security, Medicare, military salaries, interest on the national debt, tax refunds, and other payments. In other words, the borrowing that the government must issue through Treasury bonds usually is the difference between revenue in and spending out. So every year we have, at least in the last two decades, we've been running deficits. Deficits are annual differences between revenue, money coming in, and spending obligations passed by Congress and the president. All of those deficits put together is the debt.
We've seen standoffs over increasing this debt ceiling before. 2011 was, I think, the last really close call. What do people see as the consequences if we hit the point where we haven't increased the debt ceiling and we can't make up that shortfall anymore?
Well, that would be loosely called default, but default would have many options. So default could take the form of not paying investors who have bought Treasury securities. The reason why the United States is a very attractive market is our dependability. We've never defaulted. And what that means is that payments will always be on time and we will honor our debts. So the question would be whether or not those investors would be prioritized over, say, Social Security beneficiaries. If there's not enough money to go around, there would have to be some decisions about who gets paid first. But loosely, all of that could be called default, regardless of who is prioritized.
And there's concerns about what that would mean, various kinds of defaults would mean for the U.S. and even global economies, right?
Yes. It's hard to say with precision because it has never happened. But I'm looking at something called Moody's Analytics. So Moody's, of course, is a ratings agency that looks at these types of situations very closely. So Moody's Analytics and other rating agencies can only assume that there would be fallout, and that could take different forms. The economy could shrink because there would be fewer dollars in people's pockets if doctors are not paid, hospitals are not paid for Medicare, if Social Security payments don't go through. And of course, there can be market ramifications if our treasuries are not worth the investor's dollar.
So President Biden and the White House have been saying the debt ceiling isn't the time for this negotiation. We can do negotiations when we talk about the budget. House Republicans have been saying, hang on, it's a perfect time to talk about making spending cuts. Well, here we have today, just this afternoon, a House Republican outline of the cuts they would like to see go along with a debt ceiling increase. We're still digging through this thing right now. Jasmine, what is standing out to you so far?
Well, the president has said clean, and this is not clean, although it may be bipartisan. So the president has said it's a clean debt ceiling increase, no negotiation over policy. The debt ceiling, according to President Biden, is paying the bill at the end of the meal when you've already ordered and eaten it. That's not the time to talk about your budget for eating out. So he's saying it should be clean, but there, of course, is history where presidents have negotiated. Of course, President Obama had to negotiate with a Republican majority, and there were spending decreases on the table. So presidents have approached this crisis differently, and our system is complex in part because we have different majorities in different positions on different electoral clocks, and they have to work together.
And we've been waiting on Speaker McCarthy and fellow Republicans to give some details. We have at least some now. Not everything is hashed out, but spending cuts as part of their plan, cuts to the IRS, student debt relief cuts. What stood out to you when it comes to what they have on the table in exchange for a non-clean debt ceiling increase?
The biggest parts of the deficit in the last two decades are tax decreases, military spending increases, and entitlement spending increases, including the Medicare Part D passed under the second Bush administration. In addition, entitlement spending fluctuates by qualification. So when there are more people qualifying for Social Security retirement benefits, the cost will go up. So this is a combination of decision-making that has taken place over decades. And if we want to balance the budget or lower our debt, It is true that there are lots of opportunities annually for appropriations discussions, and then there are the bigger picture discussions. Appropriations annually are only about a third of the spending that the United States is obligated for every year. Two-thirds are authorizing bills, such as Social Security. So unless we decide to solve all of these problems somehow, it's going to be difficult to say that any one of them could automatically create the need for pushing the deficit ceiling down the road. It's simply too big of an ask.
Talking to Jasmine Farrier, professor of political science at the University of Louisville, looking at the debt ceiling, Republican plan on the table now, at least an outline of a plan. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Let's go to a caller now. Robert is with us in Appleton. Robert, hi.
Yeah, just a couple facts. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. They're not entitled to their own facts. 25% of the entire national debt was run up in the last 4 years under the Trump administration. There were four debt increase with no drama. The 14th Amendment says that the full faith and credit of the United States will not be questioned. The crisis in the United States has to do with the fact that historically, the top 1% in corporations are paying less taxes historically than they ever have in the past. Cutting revenue to the IRS is insane. That's the only part of the government where when you spend more money, you get more money. The one intelligent, you know, thing that's come out of this discussion is there has been something put forward by a bipartisan group of politicians that talked about putting $1 trillion worth of additional revenue. So you add taxes in order to raise $1 trillion. You invest that in the equity markets for 20 years. And so that when you have the crisis that is fully, you know, predictable of more people retiring.
Robert, I'm going to jump in because you gave us a lot to talk about already. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. I want to get to a couple of things Robert brought up, Jasmine. First of all, he mentioned the Republican plan here would say, okay, a bunch of money that was put into the IRS by the Inflation Reduction Act, most of that would come out. Robert says, wait, this is the part of the government that actually can bring in revenue. What do you think of that specific notion of clawing back that IRS money?
Yes, I think it's a very interesting idea, and Democrats have been pushing that considerably because if the existing law were enforced, deficits would be lower. And it is definitely a good political point to make about the relative ease that higher earners seem to have escaping their tax obligations under the law. So that is an important point to make. I want to go back to Robert's point about the 14th Amendment because I think this is also worth considering. There are lots of ways to deal with the debt ceiling, and one of the ways that could be on the table, I'm not sure if it is, but it could be on the table as we inch closer to what they call the X date, is that President Biden could essentially suspend the debt ceiling unilaterally. There's a section of the 14th Amendment that says that the United States debts will be honored and they can't be questioned. And while there's a Civil War context to that constitutional clause, it is nevertheless there in the 14th Amendment. It is not obvious that Congress needs to be a part of this discussion, and we can go to this if you'd like in a little bit more depth, but there have been different ways that Congress has been in and out of this discussion. It's by no means required that Congress has to get involved in the debt ceiling in this way.
Interesting. Yeah. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Well, the debt ceiling was itself created around 1917 to help with the sale of war bonds under President Wilson in World War I. And in the 1970s, under a rule that was named after former House Leader Richard Gephardt, the Gephardt rule said that automatically the debt ceiling would be increased by the annual passage of budget bills. So let's think about the logic of that. By creating the need for a deficit, by creating the need to borrow, why wouldn't Congress piggyback the debt ceiling directly onto the obligations and the revenues that they seem to have agreed upon? That was suspended. That actually took place for about 15 years. And then when Newt Gingrich and the Republican majority came in for the 104th Congress in January of 1995, the Gephardt rule was suspended. And that created these brinksmanship moments, which you might say you can quote any figure on either side. A good crisis is an opportunity to get attention to an issue of great importance. This is a crisis that the Republican Party has said time and again is worth discussing.
We're talking to Jasmine Farrier, political science professor at the University of Louisville. She's with us for a look at the politics surrounding the partisan debate over lifting the federal debt ceiling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how our federal government pays its bills? Do you have suggestions that you'd have for maybe our congressional delegation from Wisconsin about how you want to see them tackle the annual deficit, the overall debt? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Jasmine Farrier, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. We're looking at the partisan divide over raising the federal debt limit, the possibility of some kind of bipartisan compromise, what might happen if that compromise is not reached. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Mequon. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just would like to make an observation. About 80-plus percent of the debt that currently exists in the United States was put on the country's credit card over the last 20 years. It's far more than what we put on in the first, 240 years of this country. The vast majority of that debt went to wars that were unpaid for. It went to bailing out Wall Street in 2008 and then bailing out Wall Street against during the pandemic. Both parties are complicit in it. They voted for these bailouts. They voted for these wars with no way to pay for them. And now they're asking the majority of the country that pays their fair share in taxes to pick up the tab for all these other people that aren't paying their fair share in taxes. This is not a spending issue. It is a revenue issue.
Matt, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Jasmine, I mean, when you look at charts of the federal debt, it does shoot up a lot over that last 20-year period. What do you think of Matt's thoughts on the sources? What's causing that increase?
Well, he makes a very important point that it is very difficult to balance the budget or come close to it without revenue. And tax cuts that were temporary under the Bush administration at the early part of the century, of course, George W. Bush, those were temporary tax decreases. And yes, I'm sorry about that. And then when Congress issues a sunset, it's usually to argue that we will figure out the consequences later and escape any consequences right now. Under President Obama, I believe that 4/5 of those tax decreases were made permanent. And of course, he had political need to negotiate with the opposite party. So, of course, taxes were reduced again under President Trump. So, yes, the revenue is the problem. And there's no question, again, the math was correct, that most of this debt has been accumulated over the past four presidencies, two Democrats and two Republicans, and all permutations of House and Senate majorities, single Democratic governance, Republican governance, and mixed in both directions.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Ruth with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I appreciate the conversation. Thank you. And I appreciate the callers as well. I think we have to be careful when we talk about Social Security as we talk about the overall revenue and budget, because Social Security is a very different animal. This is money that comes out of, you know, payroll taxes that are there as insurance for people later in life or for other reasons with hardships in life. So I worry about talking about throwing Social Security in the mix when, in fact, it's something very different than our other taxes and our other revenues.
Ruth, thanks a lot for the call. And Jasmine, I admit, I have conceptual problems with how Social Security works. You hear that it is, as Ruth says, this separate system. But then I hear people say, well, you can't fix the deficit without tackling things like Social Security and Medicare. How does it fit into the puzzle?
Well, Social Security is, of course, a series of authorizing laws. So I think that Ruth's question, and again, by the way, Rob, your callers are very sharp, and
oh, yeah,
they're following these issues closely, and I want to commend you for that and them. So Ruth's point is very important. So this is not subject to a negotiation at the 11th hour in a debt ceiling increase crisis. Social Security was created by law in 1935, and it's been amended ever since. It is not subject to annual appropriations. It is the type of entitlement that would require separate legislative action. So there has been, of course, a looming question about whether or not the demographics of Social Security still work. The way it works right now is that we have a separate trust fund that is the source of money where your payroll taxes go and payments to Social Security recipients go out. When the Social Security trust fund is in surplus, the government, of course, borrows it, and there are some IOUs that are part of the debt ceiling there. But when there are not enough workers, then Social Security will be unable to meet its legal obligations. There are a couple of ways of fixing this. So one way is to take it out of this trust fund scenario and put it right into the regular budget. And that means you can shoot up as much deficit as the ceiling will allow. That's probably more acceptable on to the Democratic side. On the Republican side, they would say that this situation is nuanced, but at the end of the day, Social Security was not meant to support people for decades when lives are longer, medical advances are stronger, and demographics have shifted away from the surpluses that Social Security used to have. So that's a legitimate question. I'm not saying it's a legitimate argument. I'm saying that Congress has the right with the president to negotiate the types of obligations that are pressing on the deficit every year and the debt overall. Just the way we seem to not blink, Democratic or Republican presidents alike, at increasing military spending, $850 billion this year. And according to the Cost of War Project by Brown University, $6 trillion have been spent since 9/11 and not a penny raised in new revenue.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jeremy is with us now in Green Bay. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I had a question. I hear this point a lot, heard Speaker McCarthy make it again today, that just like a household, the United States government needs to balance our budget, needs to not take in less than we put out. But that always seemed like a funny comparison because households don't have the Federal Reserve. So I'm wondering if that comparison actually makes more sense than it sounds on the surface to me. Thank you so much.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. That analogy between the federal government and a household budget, Jasmine.
Well, let's imagine that we've eaten out, as I said before, we've already eaten the meal, we're presented with the bill, and we decide it's now a good time to talk about the debt that we're going to incur with our credit card. There, of course, can be good debt, bad debt, car debt, house debt, investments in student loans. The United States can sustain debt. There's no question about that. And in fact, if we remember that in the 2000 election, when it looked like we were going to have surpluses as far as the eye could see, some economists thought that that actually wasn't very healthy either. So if we're going to make a household comparison, let's say a few things. One is most households have debt. And two, the government should have a conversation about debt before the debt is incurred, not when the bill is due.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last half a minute or so, Jasmine, do you see prospects for a friendly negotiated compromise here on time?
I think it's very fraught, to be honest with you, because the majorities are so slim. If Kevin McCarthy is governing by a four-person majority, he can't afford to lose a single person. If we recall from his 15 rounds as speaker designate, before he was officially in the role, he made a lot of side deals. It seems that some of those side deals are coming back right now as pressure from the right because he promised that he would use the debt ceiling to negotiate these types of spending decreases. Let's go over to the Senate side. We have a very slim majority for the Democrats. Where is the wiggle room on either side to get something done without reaching across the aisle? That's what I worry about.
Jasmine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That was Jasmine Farrier, political science professor at the University of Louisville. She's author of books, including most recently Constitutional Dysfunction on Trial. She joined us with the latest on the approaching debt ceiling limit and the political divide between the two parties preventing an agreement on federal funding. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, explore the ever-changing world of food trends and find out what's coming to restaurants and grocery stores near you. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever eaten a little too much at a meal or a meal plus dessert, and then afterward you feel kind of logy, out of it, not quite with it? I have, as recently as last night. So what I try to do then is move around a little, maybe take a walk. Not epic exercise, just a little something. Turns out I may be on the right track. As reported in the New York Times science section, a new study rounds up a bunch of studies on light exercise after a meal. A couple of the studies included people with diabetes or pre-diabetes. The rest didn't. They focused on walking after a meal as a form of exercise. Conclusions? A little bit of walking after a meal actually helps bring down elevated blood sugar levels, which is good. We already knew that 15 minutes of walking could do that, apparently, but according to these studies, even just a couple few minutes can make a significant difference. So I'm going to keep doing this. Probably help even more if I didn't eat two crullers for dessert like I did last night. Exercise news you can use. This is Central Time.